Order. We're going to do a quick work session on House Bill 2968. We'll open the work session on that bill. Colleagues, this bill is needed in the Ways and Means Committee for work. I'm proposing that we send it to them without any amendments and without a recommendation. Ask the staff to send along the amendments that have been proposed. We have three of them, but they have a need for the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2968 be moved without recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2968 without recommendation to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Excused.
Yes.
Aye.
Excused. Excused. Aye. The motion having received the required majority, the bill goes to Ways and Means. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2968 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1036. Senator Deckert. And there may be, are there others?
Oops.
Senator Schrader yields his time.
No, I want to see him actually say yes to somebody.
All right. Senator, it's great to see you today.
Good to see you. Thank you for allowing less than 2 minutes. Mr. Chair, Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Washington County and a little bit of Multnomah. Senate Bill 1036, to me, is one of those few bills that you get, and I hope I'm sure there will be a robust debate. It's one of those few bills that you get that comes with a great deal of diverse support that we're not used to, tackling a problem that is statewide and a solution that is statewide, and that is school construction. So for the first time, at least in my tenure here, and I think prior to that, I think decades and decades, you have developers and those who represent the development community along with groups that are coming, Stand for Children, the school boards, OSEA, the School Employees Association, Oregon Education Association, and so many other important groups advocating for education. And so that is the unlikely combination of groups that you have, I believe, that will testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1036, that I believe will make a real difference for school construction. The one caveat I would add is that you might not hear, but it's an important voice that I've talked to in terms of some school board members and school administrators, and I think it's an important question for this committee to ask, is do you want this bill? Because there's almost two schools of thought out there. It is the ultimate, what we really, really want in terms of school capital, and perhaps that's the California environment where new growth pays 100% of the freight for new schools. And you have this proposal, which is a more modest proposal. It certainly does not solve the school capital problem. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's an important debate. I know where I fall on that continuum, having been here long enough and in a process that is designed to defeat things. And I think that is, if nothing else, the process that we have is designed to defeat things. And the battle scars are just everywhere of defeated ideas. And so I fall into the camp of let's get something done that puts $60 million on the board for school construction every single year. And that is the camp that I fall into because it's a camp that hasn't existed for quite some time. But I think it's an important question that I know, Mr. Chair, you may pose to some of the superintendents and school boards. Is this something you want and you will utilize? Because if it's not, then we ought not do it. And perhaps we can come back in a future session and work for what maybe is that ultimate goal for some. The only caution I would add, and that's why I'm here testifying in support, is it's been a long time coming. It's been a long time since we've asked new growth and developers to help participate in the construction of schools, and I think that's an important milestone, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We appreciate it. We'll hear from Steve.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1036 deals with the construction tax for the use of school districts. It allows school districts to impose the tax on new construction measured by square footage of improvements. It requires that the revenue generated be used for capital improvements, and it defines capital improvements in the bill. It sets a maximum tax rate of $1 per square foot for residential property, 50 cents for commercial, and 25 for industrial construction. It sets limits of $25,000 on commercial structures and industrial permits. It would index those rates beginning in 2010. And it has specific exemptions in the bill, including affordable housing. It would also grant the school districts that would choose to impose the tax to have additional exemption in their authority. The school districts would also have to develop long-term facility plans if they wanted to impose the tax. It would require that there be an intergovernmental agreement with other governments for collecting the tax, and it would limit the expense for collection to 1% of the revenue collected. Local government is preempted from using the construction tax until 2018, but any local governments that currently have it would be grandfathered in if the tax is already in effect as of May 1, 2007. Mr. Chair, there was some discussion and the suggestion that various amendments be considered by the committee. I assume that they'll be proposed today, and there may be a few technical amendments that would improve the bill a little bit.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't have a staff meeting summary.
I don't think any of the rest of us do either.
Okay.
So perhaps we can ask for that to be distributed to the committee during the testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Broom.
Question of staff. I'm looking at first page lines 10 through 12, and it says construction taxes do not include SDCs imposed under various ORS. This bill does not preempt or preclude any existing SDC structure that a local government may have. Separate issues.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broom, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Other questions? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, it just occurs to me that a $1 per square foot on a residence, a 2,000 square foot residence, would be a couple of $1,000 in addition to the SDCs. And the concern that I would express coming right out of the box is those communities that have the SDCs and or may already have local government construction tax in addition to the SDCs. My concern is, would this have a chilling effect on new construction or reconstruction? And I appreciate the fact that it has exemptions specified in effect for affordable housing. But my concern is, would this have a chilling effect on the real estate markets, on any new real estate development, particularly where those of us who live in border communities, whether it be with California, with Idaho, or Washington, recognize that the construction may already be much cheaper in those states.
Is that a question?
That's a question of staff.
Mr. Chair, Butler, that's possible. There was some testimony on the other side that the percentage increase at $2,000 as a percent of a $200,000+ home probably would not have much of an impact on the number of new construction.
2,000 here, 2,000 there. Pretty soon you're talking affordable housing going out the window in my community. Excuse me,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Butler. We have a number of people who would like to be heard this afternoon. We have about an hour that we can use today for this, so I'm going to ask those who have written testimony to summarize. We'll look at it, and I'll ask the committee members to read it. And I'm going to call people in panels. You may not know or like each other, but we're doing it for efficiency's purposes, and that's all. Thank you very much. Pauline McGuire, Julie Volpe, and Dana Hepper.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee members. My name is Pauline McGuire, and I'm a member of Stanford Children and a parent in the North Clackamas School District, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1036. Over the past 3 years, I have found myself learning more than I ever imagined on the building industry in Oregon. I have attended numerous planning commission meetings, talked with area planners, mayors, superintendents around the state, county commissioners, and with area many individuals in the planning and school arenas in other states as well. I have no job related to this. It all came from being a parent of a new kindergartner at Oregon Trail Elementary in Clackamas, Oregon. You may be asking yourselves why this would be so, and I have an answer for you. When my oldest son started school, it quickly became apparent that his school was overcrowded and gaining more and more students than the school had space for. I asked a question about the growing community and the connection to schools, and no one had an answer, and I wanted an answer. This is what led me on a journey to find one. With the help of Stanford Children and numerous individuals around the state, we are here today to hopefully have a part of this question answered. Senate Bill 1036 is a tool that school districts in our state desperately need. Development happens faster than districts can keep up with. The fees collected from the implementation of Senate Bill 1036 would help school districts to be more proactive rather than having to scramble to add additional classrooms via portable buildings. Currently, in Oregon, schools have no tool or voice to deal with rapid development or the other numerous capital needs. The time is way overdue to help our schools on a state level. We need a more responsible plan other than only relying on taxpayers through the bonding process. Senate Bill 1036 will not solve all capital needs that school districts have, but it is a place to start. Schools are an essential part of a community, whether you have children or not. The success of our state is in the hands of the next generations, and they cannot succeed without education. It is a responsibility of us all to make sure our kids have the best learning environment possible. I urge you to move quickly on getting Senate Bill 1036 to a vote and into state law so schools can start using this much-needed tool sooner than rather than later. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 1036. My name is Julie Volpel. I live in the North Clackamas School District, where my three teenagers attend school. I joined Stanford Children 3 years ago with the intention of joining like-minded people in an effort to make our community a good place for kids, starting with having the high-quality schools I knew kids deserved. As we watched new developments go up almost daily, our local Stanford Children team raised the issue of why developers were allowed to build without regard to their impact on schools. A few months later, we attended our first Clackamas County Planning Commission meeting and learned that Windswept Waters, a 600-home development, would be allowed to proceed in spite of our superintendent's protest that it would cause additional overcrowding in our schools that already use trailers or portable classrooms. My daughter's sixth-grade class was being held in a community center as her elementary school had over 800 children enrolled. My son's junior high had again added additional portables to deal with overcrowding. Hallways jammed with students became the norm. We did not want portable classrooms or trailers to become an acceptable substitute for true classrooms. We knew something had to change. We talked to county commissioners, planners, and legislators, and here's what we learned. We learned that schools had no voice in the planning process, that schools were not considered part of the critical infrastructure, unlike roads, sewers, and parks. So we started to research what worked in other states. We're learning that 11 other states were successfully using school impact fees, including California and Washington. In fact, many residents who moved from those states believe that impact fees or something like them were in place in Oregon. We also learned that bonds were the only tool available to school districts to get money for new school construction or renovation. 75% of states provide state support for school construction. Oregon does not. We knew that bonds were often hard to pass. Our Stanford Children chapter and many other school districts around Oregon worked hard this last year, passing millions of dollars worth of bonds, $229 million in our district alone. Impact fees or construction excise tax can reduce the amount of bond money asked for by schools by up to 25%, depend on the district. We even researched the feasibility of a ballot measure in 2006, both with and without the partnership of Oregon Home Builders Association, but then it would have jeopardized the many bond measures so desperately needed in the high-growth areas. We rejected the concept of a shared park school impact fee. Stanford Children members have testified at legislative hearings last session on bills that didn't make it out of committee. People across the state care about this issue, and the message that we heard over and over again was that growth needed to help pay for its impact on schools. The Home Builders Association suggested a compromise that spread the responsibility to commercial and industrial properties as well. The original purpose of our involvement was to ask growth to help pay for its impact on the community. However, businesses and the community benefit from a strong school district with adequate facilities and operating budget. Families are attracted to and buy homes in those communities that support education. Businesses can more easily attract employees to communities that support schools. We all win when members of the community, whether taxpayer or business owner, support giving kids a safe and adequate place to learn. This bill will not solve each school's facility challenges, but it does provide a tool to school districts and their school boards. So let's make a positive change for our Oregon schools, and please vote yes for supporting that Senate Bill 1036.
Thank you.
And I'll be really brief. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children, and just want to say this tool can make a difference for high-growth school districts across the state, and you just heard from Julie and Pauline about why this is so important. But I want to point out that this tool specifically can also make a difference for school districts that have declining enrollment or flat enrollment, school districts that whose buildings may compromise student health with wood rot, mold, pest infections, school districts whose computer access is limited due to lack of technology, outdated outlets, that kind of thing. And also just wanted to make the point that school facilities, common sense tells us, but also research shows that the quality of school facilities is directly connected to student achievement. And so we urge you to support this bill because we think it can help us address these problems across the state. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Broom.
Hi. It's a question for you, Dan, if you would. In our staff measure summary, and it was mentioned earlier that this raises $60 million a year. I know that your organization was part of the groundwork, if you will, to sort of come up with this. And my first question would be, was the $60 million a year determined based, here's what our need is, and so we're going to back into finding what the per square foot rate should be, or did it come up, we think this is the fair square foot rate, and we end up getting to $60 million? What came first, I guess?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brown, it was more the latter. We basically looked at what we thought was a reasonable, feasible rate, and then found out how much it raised.
Gotcha.
The need is much greater, and we don't expect that builders would pay the entire cost of building new schools, because that would be, I think, unduly burdensome on developers and purchasers of homes and other development. So we looked at what we thought was a reasonable rate.
Could I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Dan. $60 million, I mean, great testimony about the need, and the need is clear and obvious, at least in my mind. $60 million a year, though, we know how expensive capital construction is, but it's still a lot. It's money that's not there now for the school building and school improvements that are going now. This is taking the current system and adding $60 million. I guess my concern, and I'm not asking for a commitment or anything like that, but my concern mirrors those mentioned by Representative Butler, in that we're talking, I know there's exemptions for low-income housing, but there's a wide, in fact, I would argue probably the biggest menu out there, if you will, for housing are those people that may not qualify for that, but they're still sort of in their young years. And adding $2,000 to a 2,000 square foot house is going to have a very chilling, in my opinion, have a very chilling effect on the housing market. Is your group amenable, or would you consider being amenable to backing off that $60 million a little bit, given sort of how you got there by, I won't say accident, but it was.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Broom, the figure we decided on with the Home Builders Association is pretty firm at this point. We've spent a lot of time in negotiation, and we think that what we've come up with is a reasonable figure. And certainly this, you know, won't solve all the problems, and we have worked with, Stand for Children has worked with other groups to develop a package of five bills, one of which is being heard over in House Education today, a few of which are being heard in Senate Revenue tomorrow morning, that help to address the school facilities problem across the board. So this is just one tool, but we're very comfortable with the current rate and would like that to be the rate that passes out of this committee.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Alice Norris, Joe Schweinhart, Anyone else here representing cities today who wants to, who's on the list? Thank you. You'd come forward. I think I have two from counties, so we'll bring you up later. Thank you.
Wait. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, actually am going to talk about an exemption that I would like to support for our city, exempting brownfields.
And would you identify yourself for the record?
Excuse me, I am Alice Norris, the mayor of Oregon City.
Thank you.
And I also have to say that I'm rather familiar with Capital Construction for Schools, as I was the campaign coordinator for the first school bond measure to pass in Oregon City in 27 years after three tries. So, but I'd like to talk today with another hat on about the city's economic process. Our city of 29,000 was left behind during the boom periods in Oregon's economic development. In fact, Oregon City became part of the solution for many of the Portland region's problems. We now have, because of that, on or near our waterfront and on our border with the city of Gladstone, we have 180 acres that contain two closed landfills, a metro garbage transfer station, a man-made gravel pit draining into the Clackamas River, and a sewage treatment plant. Now our city has been designated a regional center in Metro's 2040 growth plan, and we're preparing for our role as a service provider to a population of 100 to 150,000 people. This area is extremely important to us because of the development that will minimize sprawl and maintain our city services. And our growth is centered around this landfill, transfer station, etc. So we would like to urge you to support a brownfield exemption because that's what this area is. We now have two projects in due diligence that are going to be built in this area, we hope, that have the ability to stimulate our economy, transform this wasteland, and provide needed employment choices in housing, transportation, and services. In fact, the numbers are for these proposed developments that on the landfill, an additional $18 million will be needed to put pilings down to the bedrock underneath the garbage, and an additional $6 million to vent for the methane gas on this brownfield. So it would add to the cost of construction for us. Because these sites are so difficult to develop and redevelop because of the unknown costs and the higher risk associated with them, we urge you to exempt brownfields from, if you consider the construction excise tasks, because it is an extremely important project to our community, which has limited ability to incent those kinds of developments. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Schweinhardt, the City of Salem. The mayor and city council asked me to come before you today and talk to you about this bill. I'm not going to get into all the reasons, but there's a few I'd like to address. First of all, like I said, they understand the need for schools. Salem is growing very, very fast, and the need for schools is very important. We just don't think this bill gets you there. We don't think, in fact, Senator Decker made the statement that this does not get the schools to where they need to be. It is also my understanding many of the school systems will not use this tool. And we believe it's bad public policy to preempt one public body, and it's even worse public policy to then have the other public body not use the pre-exemption, preemption opportunity, which leads us to a lost revenue tool. This is an important issue. This is something the schools need some help, but we don't think this is the way to go. We think preempting local government is the wrong way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? I have one for the mayor. Ma'am, do you expect the school district that covers the area that includes the brownfields would utilize this tool if it were available?
I assume they would.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mike, let's see. I better go to those who were wondering. Andy and Gil. You looked anxious back there, so I thought I'd better get you up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm going to address the preemption. I'm not going to belabor the situation with Secure Rural Schools, federal safety net predicament that we're in, but I do want to add some comments. counties agree that schools should be appropriately funded. In fact, we are an integral part of the education support system in the state. We assess and collect over $1.5 billion a year for K through 12 in property taxes. That's more than twice what we collect for ourselves. We maintain roads that serve as all-weather bus routes. We provide libraries, at least we used to, and museums for study. We provide children and family services, developmental disabled services, public and mental health services, and when there's a problem, we provide law enforcement and juvenile services. To remain an essential part of the education support system and to provide other important public services, we need fiscal tools, particularly now with the fading away of federal safety net money. In other words, we don't need the preemption. We ask that you take the preemption out. Remember that general law counties and those counties with charters, the nine counties with charters that do not say otherwise, if they put this proposal forward, it has to go to the voters for approval before it's implemented, before it takes effect. And in any event, counties are subject to recall and referendum. So this is not a tool that will be used lightly, if at all, but this, the fact is we need as many as we can get for local situations in this particularly troublesome period fiscally. That's my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. Andy Shaw with the League of Oregon Cities. First, I want to echo that certainly cities view schools as a critical part of our local communities, and we're as eager as anyone to help high-growth cities solve this financing problem. But our cities can't support removing a tool that we have at our disposal that some of our cities use and some haven't used yet in order to provide a tool for another local government partner. What this bill asks you to do is to trade away city and county taxing authority in order to provide a very limited tool to raise revenue for what we guess will be a handful of school districts. We think that's a poor trade-off. Under Measures 5 and 50, we have pretty severe limitations on our ability to raise property taxes to meet our needs. We've had no gas tax increase since 1993, which is one of the major sources of funding for local road maintenance. But cities are facing the reality of having to accommodate most of the million new residents we expect to come to Oregon in the next 15 to 20 years. With severe property tax limitations, cities and counties have sought other ways to fund the services that our residents and businesses demand. We look at user fees, local taxes, and asking development to help pay for the impacts that development creates. More and more frequently, however, we're finding that as cities use these new sources of revenues, the industries affected by those new taxes come to the state seeking protection. Preemptions to provide specific industries to protect specific industries are usually discussed in the context of some sort of significant trade-off. The liquor tax preemption that was established many years ago was balanced by the sharing of state liquor revenues. Cities and counties receive nearly half of the liquor revenues that are distributed by the state. The transient occupancy tax, the lodging tax preemption, was less balanced and has sharply limited cities' ability to address the impacts of tourism on local infrastructure and local tourism-related services. Now we're hearing discussions about preempting local government's use of the local gas tax if there's a significant statewide tax increase in gas. All of these efforts to preempt local governments fail to recognize that our 242 cities are very different. They have different needs and very different abilities to raise the revenues they need to meet those needs. One of the ways we do raise revenues is to charge new development in order to meet the needs and address the impacts of growth. This bill attempts to make new development help to pay for schools that are needed to accommodate new families. Cities share that concern. We want development to help pay for its impacts. A number of cities are in process of looking establishing an excise tax. Medford is looking at establishing an excise tax to pay for planning, so that development pays for the cost of planning, permitting, engineering, and those types of services. They would be preempted under this bill. Wilsonville is looking to use the City of Bend's model to fund the growth, the construction of affordable housing in a community where housing prices are growing so rapidly that they don't have affordable housing available for low-income families. They would be preempted under this bill. Rogue River wants to identify funds to supplement its $104,000 street fund in order to maintain its downtown roads. Growth in that city is impacted directly by development that's going on, and they have established a street impact fee that is an excise tax that would help supplement that road fund to help maintain their downtown roads. They actually would not be preempted by this bill. So what does Senate Bill 1036 trade for these tools that cities are looking to use? The bill authorizes a very limited tool for addressing school capital needs. First, in our view, the bill would not raise $60 million. In talking with local school districts, we do not believe that many school districts will opt to use this tool. That $60 million estimate is based on every school district in the state adopting the tool. Even at that rate, we think the revenue estimates are high, maybe by 2 to 3 times. Legislative revenue did a yeoman's job in trying to identify what the potential revenues were, but we're finding that their estimates don't match the figures that we're getting from cities. We've requested square footage of permitted projects from a variety of cities, and in comparing them, we think the estimates are probably too high. Beaverton, for example, the legislative revenue estimate was could raise $2.7 million. From the figures we have, we think they'd raise about $1 million, which is 36% of that estimate. City of Wilsonville, the legislative revenue estimates they'll raise about $860,000 a year, and our estimate is more like $450,000, which is about half of that amount. The school districts that we're talking to, one of the reasons that they have indicated they probably wouldn't use this is they really are focusing on general obligation bonds. The city of Medford, in talking with their school district, their school district just got a $188 million bond approved to build and address school facilities. That compares with a very low amount that would be raised annually with this fee. So we're not here, though, calling for you to delete the preemption clause from the bill. We have a series of amendments that we've given to you which would provide relief to cities but still allow some protection for development interests. The first amendment that you have, which is the Dash 14s, would move the bill forward with the tool that's been discussed for school districts, but cap city and county authority to raise excise taxes. That's sort of a shared ability to raise taxes to address local needs. The second amendment you have before you would say that where a school district does not choose to pick up this tool after a period of 3 years, and we just picked that number because we think the school districts that want this tool are probably ready to go. They're probably going to enact it soon. Those that aren't won't choose to in that time frame. And after that, a city or a county could choose to retain its authority to raise excise taxes. The third option, and our least favorite option, would be to exchange the preemption in the bill, recast it as a freeze on local governments for a 5-year period, allowing a time frame during which school districts can choose to use this and pick up this tool, begin to see how it works, and then we would go back to having city authority to raise these taxes. We urge you seriously to consider these options as decent alternatives, a better trade-off than the bill in its current form. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is probably the panel that I would address this question to, and I want to do so in a quick manner because I know the time is pressing. My concern deals with your building departments. We have county and city building departments that overlap one another. Those folks are going to be part of the intergovernmental agreement that's provided for under Section 5. Is there any fixed method of collecting of these SDCs, this additional SDC presently, and where it overlaps into a school district because that's outside of a city, excuse me, where I live?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we worked very closely within the work group process to make sure this bill could work. We checked with cities to talk about how could they assess this fee as a part of the permitting process, and we don't see any trouble in actually implementing the fee during the permitting process. The bill would provide 1% of revenues, up to 1% of the revenues as a reimbursement to cities to fund that activity, and the cities that we've talked to don't see any trouble in both implementing it and that amount of money to pay for those services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we since cities have far more experience than we do with this, we followed the lead with the cities. They said it would work, so particularly the fee structure would accommodate the costs to counties. And I assume that the jurisdiction of where the fees would be paid would depend upon on which jurisdiction control that area.
Mr. Chair, my concern is that I have overlapping jurisdictions, excuse me, with both state and county and city jurisdictions that would affect the same personal residence, not within the city, but could be within the state's jurisdiction and within a county jurisdiction. And I don't know that they're collecting any SDCs presently because of the onerous requirements. And that's a concern for me when it involves private companies that have these inspection programs and the fee permitting programs. Is that, you don't see that as a problem when you involve a private company? Because as I read number five, it talks about going to the local governments to impose that. Presently, the local governments that have contracts with the private providers would then have to modify those private contracts. But you don't see that as a problem?
Only to the extent that the 1% of revenues didn't cover that cost. It would cover the cost where those permitting services are in-house. I guess, frankly, we hadn't considered a privatized scenario, and maybe the bill could be modified to allow for up to 1% or costs. But all of that would be negotiated within the intergovernmental agreement.
1997, Senate Bill 38 encouraged local governments to privatize those as much as possible. And so we took that as encouragement locally in rural Oregon to encourage the inspection programs to speed up. And so that, as long as you folks can work it out, I'm assuming that it does work out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. Mike Dewey, Bruce Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for sake of time here, I'll start. Mike Dewey, I represent Triad Hospital Systems, and it's a unique entity in that they have two private hospitals that operate in Springfield, hopefully in a few years, building a new hospital in Eugene. Their, if you will, competitor, Sacred Heart, is building a new hospital in Springfield. The chair is very aware of those circumstances. There's been some discussion about exemptions, and I'm not here to talk about the policy of the bill. That's for you to decide. And it's unique that Mr. Bishop is next to me. And if I may take leave after this discussion, I've got a meeting with the leadership on this particular bill. So, again, I'll be brief. It's my understanding that there's been some discussion from the leadership about certain exemptions in nonprofits and not allowing for-profit hospitals to be exempt from the bill. And from a policy standpoint, we think there ought to be some equity parity with regard to that. As you can imagine, for-profit hospitals do provide charity care. $12 million in 06 for McKenzie, Willamette, and Springfield. That's 7.3%. That's charity care and uncompensated care, 7.3% of their gross revenues. They paid in 2005 $540,000 in property taxes. So we're doing our share, if you will, to schools, for schools, and the infrastructure. So we think it's very important that there be parity here, in particular because we compete with other hospitals. And if other hospitals are not paying the same fees, it's not fair from our standpoint. And by having that competition, it's good for the consumer. It's good for the consumer from the standpoint of the quality of service, and it's good from the standpoint of, if you will, with transparency. And we're dealing with the transparency bills this session and last session with regard to cost, and also with regard to the competition with regard to cost going to hospital A or B. So if the bill moves forward, and we do not have a position on the bill, but we do think with regard to parity that if hospitals that are nonprofit or to be excluded, for-profit, which are two hospitals, would be excluded also. Be very happy to answer any questions. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We would be here in support of Senate Bill 1036 in its originally introduced form.
As introduced, the bill had an exception for hospitals, and hospitals would not have been subject to the proposed construction fees. That exemption was taken out in the Senate. Our preference would be that that exemption be restored. We don't believe that a case has been made, or would be made, frankly, that hospitals should be assessed for the purposes of school construction. Hospitals are not causing growth in communities. Just like schools, they're responding to the needs of the communities for specialized medical care. We don't believe that the assessment of hospitals for school construction purposes is warranted, and would ask that the committee consider restoring the original language in the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one question, and this is really prompted by Mr. Dewey's comments. What proportion of the hospital beds in Oregon, if you know, are nonprofits versus for-profit hospitals?
Mr. Chair, I can't tell you on a proportionate bed basis, but as Mr. Dewey testified, there are two for-profit hospitals in the state. All of the rest of the hospitals are nonprofit or governmental, and I would guess that's probably 97% or 98% of the beds in the state, a very high percentage.
I'd
get that number for you if you'd like, but I don't have it.
I don't think that it matters. That would have been my guess as well. Other representative,
Gelser.
Gelser, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forget my name sometimes too. Mr. Dewey, in his testimony, mentioned 7.3% in uncompensated care costs. And I was wondering, when that's calculated, is that calculated based on what is billed, that full cost, or what would have been brought in if it was paid at the insurance rate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I believe the typical way of reporting uncompensated costs in hospitals would be based on hospital charges.
So that full rate rather than what they would have been reimbursed if
that's
it was an insurance company. Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand correctly, Bruce, presently the way the bill has been modified in the A and Gross version, nonprofit hospitals would be required per square foot. I assume that they would be probably commercial under definition to pay the fee. And so if we were to put, and that's one of the things that is actually growing in Eastern Oregon, planted in Eastern Oregon, are some of these nonprofit health clinics and medical clinics and those kinds of things. Right now, the way the bill stands, those folks would be required to pay if they've got an adopted system development charge for the schools under this bill. They would be required to pay at least, would it be the commercial rate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe the way the bill sits before you now, hospitals and other medical care facilities would be subject to the construction fee assessment, so they would be required to pay. It's a little difficult for me to know whether those are considered commercial properties or not if they're tax exempt. So, you know, Mr. Meyer might be able to clarify that issue as to what constitutes a commercial property, but, you know, most hospitals at least are tax exempt, so I don't know if they're commercial or not.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mike Finney, Don Schulenberg, Jim Green.
Mike Finney or Kevin Finney?
I'm sorry, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's the name that I didn't have any trouble pronouncing.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Kevin Finney with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I'll be brief today. We think the need is real. We support the legislation. We do have a concern about not imposing an additional burden on churches and other nonprofit organizations that are taking social services into these expanding areas. And so we would encourage you to consider an amendment to provide an exemption for churches and nonprofit organizations. That's really all I want to say today.
Thank you. I'm detecting a theme here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Agriculture, another nonprofit organization.
And not intentionally, we hope.
No, not intentionally. as introduced when we looked at the bill and looked at the different rates that were considered, and it talked about residential, it talked about industrial, it talked about commercial, and then we wondered, where's agriculture in that? Are we neither fish nor fowl, to use an agricultural term? And we weren't sure. We talked to the proponents about that. They indicated their intent was to exempt agricultural buildings, and they asked, how would we go about doing that? There is a statute that provides for exemptions from building permits for agricultural buildings. It's in ORS 455.315, and would highly recommend that you adopt that language as an exemption for agricultural buildings. We're neutral at this point on the bill, but would appreciate that consideration. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative Butler.
I would make a comment that an onion storage is, and I've got the size of the buildings here, that's about the only 100,000 square foot building that I have in Eastern Oregon would be an onion storage building, so that was one of my questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I am not here seeking an exemption for anyone. And I am so happy that everyone in the room understands the problem and wants to help schools with the problem. And let me tell you what the problem is. We have huge capital construction needs in all of our school districts across this state, in addition to the report that was released to you folks yesterday from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, where every school district will be touched by if we have a seismic event. But those aren't the things that have gone on in school districts. What's gone on in school districts is we have one ability to raise dollars to deal with capital construction. We have one, and that's our local bond issues. We've been working for several bienniums to try to get something for schools. And everybody talks about preemption. Well, we have the mother of all preemption at school districts. We don't have the ability to use anything currently to help us with our local bonds. And this is an opportunity under Senate Bill 1036 to give school districts a tool, if they so choose to use it, to help out with capital construction. Is it going to solve the problem? No. It's not going to solve the problem. It is a piece of the puzzle that will help school districts with the problem that they're currently facing with regard to capital construction. Under Senate Bill 1036, as it's currently drafted, and then I want to go into some amendments that will be presented at a later date to you that have been focused on some of the discussion today, school districts have the opportunity to adopt a resolution through their boards to impose this tax. And it would be, as it's currently in the bill, $1 per square foot on residential, 50 cents for commercial, and 25 cents for industrial. That's where I want to diverge in talking about an amendment that we've all kind of agreed to on this bill, because when we sat down and started looking at the issue of how do you define commercial and how do you define industrial, I think Representative Butler may have hit the nail on the head with that. And we looked at, okay, so you get a building that's going to be built in industrial land, but it's really a commercial building. What would be the tax assessed? So we've all kind of coalesced around the idea of saying, let's get away from defining commercial. Let's get away from defining industrial. Let's call it residential, and let's call it non-residential. And to change the amounts on non-residential from the differentiation of 50 cents and 25 cents, let's just make it 50 cents for non-residential and cap it at the $25,000 that's currently in the bill. So we don't have to get into the battle of defining what is commercial and what's industrial. We know what residential is, and if it's not residential, then it's non-residential. I think that gets at some of the issues that may be percolating in the committee and with folks that are in the audience today. Again, I want to be real clear on this. Not every school district, and we have 197 school districts in this state, are going to implement this. And in some instances, they may not do so because they don't believe it raises enough or they don't have growth going on. But there are school districts in the state who need this additional tool. And they can use it under the bill to acquire land. I was before the Salem-Keizer School Board last night, your school district, Representative Berger, and they were very supportive of this because they looked at what it would do for the Salem-Keizer School District. We have huge growth going on in here. I think you heard from the representative from the city of Salem. In West Salem and in South Salem, there is huge growth needs going on, and our schools are being pinched.
What they indicated at the Salem-Keizer School Board they'd use these dollars for is to help with the acquisition of land. Land is very expensive. Land is at a premium within the urban growth boundary. So they would use it to help with those issues. Is it going to build a school? No, it's not going to build a whole school. But as I said before, it's one piece of the puzzle that we can use in order to help with what's gone on in our schools over the last 15 years, where we have not had the ability to have any other tool other than our local bond elections. And those are elections that are tough to win. And we've won some, and we've lost a lot, and our schools show that. If you go to the K-12 public schools, and I happen to go to one every day when I drop my son off, we need help in our public K-12 school system with regard to our facilities, and this is one piece of the puzzle. As to some of the exemptions that have been talked about and some of the amendments that are going to be flowing through this committee, I think Mr. Schellenberg's amendment is one that we had agreed to that we would bring over from the Senate side to exempt those agricultural buildings, and there is an amendment being drafted, and I appreciate Mr. Schellenberg's citing us for that ORS, because I think that's probably where we'll look to for that exemption. Exemptions, I believe the gentleman from the Ecumenical Ministries will also be addressed, because Representative Hunt, who has been a big supporter of this, indicates that he'd like an exemption for bona fide religious institutions, which we support as well. There'll be exemptions in there for private and public schools. Why would we want to put a building excise tax on ourselves that we would then return to ourselves? It doesn't make much sense. And I think there's going to be ongoing negotiations as it relates to hospitals, whether they're in or whether they're out. But if you took a look at this bill on a statewide basis, it would have raised, I think the last time we checked, and it's hard to get accurate data because it's a new issue for schools, it would have raised about $90 million. That's the same as an SDC for schools across the state. That's if it were enacted by every school district in the state. And I can tell you today, not every school district in this state is going to enact them. Representative Butler, you have a large geographic portion of the state with some very small school districts, and I don't believe the Burnt River School District will probably enact a building excise tax, because there's probably not a lot of building going on out there in the Burnt River School District. But Representative Barnhart and Eugene, they're excited about this. The board down there, this weekend we held our legislative policy committee, and several of their members said they're very excited about this opportunity and support it. The same with the Albany School District and as well as the Salem-Keizer School District. I think you're going to hear from school districts around the state that, well, it doesn't solve the problem. And again, I'll say it doesn't solve the problem. We know that. But it does give us an additional tool that we need in the K-12 community, because, you know, you can hear all you want to about preemption, and I think you're going to hear a list here pretty soon of what other local governments can raise. You know, I think Mr. Shaw from the League of Oregon Cities talked to you about a gas tax and a liquor tax and maybe an urban renewal district and all those things. Guess what, folks? We don't have that in the K-12 community. We have one way to help with capital construction, and we need this additional tool. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, Jim. What do you have to offer for the cities and local governments relative to the preemption?
Ms. Chairman and Representative Butler, I believe if you took a look at the bill, it is a 10-year preemption. That preemption sunsets in 10 years. I have to tell you, you know, generally we work very closely with our friends in local government on a variety of issues. But on this issue, we believe that this has been available to them for in excess of 75 years. I can't go back and tell you the number of years. There are, I believe, 6 localities in this state that have used it. I can tell you right now, I know more than 6 school districts that will use this in the first year that it's enacted.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I have serious concerns about this proposal on a number of levels. As you know, I've been pretty active in Salem-Keizer Schools, and the growth that you outlined is right in the middle of my district. But by the time we're through with exemptions, what's that $60 million going to be, and what impact is it going to have when you go for a bond, because it won't build so much as a grade school in Salem-Keizer in terms of what it could possibly, you know, fund. And yet it gives the argument that, oh, we don't need to go for a bond, or you know, why are you asking me for bond money when the state's taking care of it, or I'm already paying taxes on my new house. It sort of splits the baby in such a way that I'm not sure anybody's going to get anything out of this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, we share that concern because of the idea of, let's say a local school board does enact this resolution, the public goes, well, we've solved the problem. I think that school district And their activists and their advocates in that school district need to tell the story that what they're going to use that for first, how much it will raise, and how much their need is out there still. And you're right. Will it create some problems in some school districts with regard to bond elections? It may. But what I would say is then that school district doesn't have to use this as a tool if they don't want to. But there are school districts who need this tool. I think one of the things that school districts need to do, and our association will work very closely with them when they adopt a resolution like this and in their bond campaigns, to help them with messaging so that they show when they adopt the resolution what exactly this proposal will raise and what they intend to use that for. And here is still our additional need out there beyond this, and where we need to go from here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Representative Gerber. those who do not enact it because of the reason we just gave, that the voters would say, well, you've already got this tool, you don't need a bond, will then be hammered with the other argument, which is you had a tool, you didn't use it, but you're coming to us with this other thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, either way, it's a lose-lose, I think, in some measure. Messaging, you're right, works to some degree, but so does the message that I had to pay $2,000 more for my new house and it was only a, you know, starter home, and now you're coming back to me for more. And also, you know, that big guy down the street didn't have to pay anything, but I did on residential. I'm just not sure that this is going to get schools anywhere near where they think it's going to take them. And I put that on the record now. You can talk to me about it later, and particularly with regard to what happened at the school board last night.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I would say one of the reasons that we like Senate Bill 1036 is that it is not just an SDC on residential construction. It does spread the load, and it allows for school districts who may not have growth in residential but have growth in what we would call non-residential under the amendment, to have the ability to get some funds from those folks to help with the issues they've got with capital construction issues. And I would enjoy having the conversation about the Sam Kaiser School Board meeting last night.
Thank you. I have a technical question actually that was suggested by Representative Butler. In Measure 50, there is a definition of capital improvement for the purpose of bonding under Measure 50. I think the definition in Section 6, the end of the bill, is a little different and a little more expansive because it refers to equipment and furnishings as well as some of these other things. Is that your view as well, or have I missed it somehow?
Mr. Chairman, that is my view as well. We are trying to make this as broad as possible for school districts to have the advantage to do things outside of just what the Measure 50 limits say with regard to Measure 5 limits say with regard to what we can use bond proceeds for. We're trying to make this broad because there are different needs in our different school districts across the state. If you take a look, and I think the amendments may bear this out as well when we present those to the committee, purchasing of technology, of furnishings that go in the building is something that school districts are going to use this for. And I think that's some of the where school districts are saying, we haven't been able to use our current bond proceeds for this. This is a new tool. Why shouldn't we be able to use it to address the needs that go on in a building? We can go ahead and build a building with a bond. But what's surprising is you can't put the teacher's desk or the kids' desks in there. And we need to have that ability. We're trying to make this as broad as possible so that school districts can use it. Now, remember, school districts could also say we're not going to use it for that. Yeah. And they could also grant exemptions within their own resolution of other types of buildings that they would want to exempt. There's nothing in this bill or in the amendments that are going to come forward that would stop a school district from granting further exemptions or actually charging less than the dollar per square foot for residential. You have to understand, we're trying to build a bill here that gives us the most flexibility but gives us that additional tool.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your testimony. John Chandler, Joe Basler, and Mark Wilton. Whitlow, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, can I bring up my buddies from schools to join me in testimony on this bill? I don't believe they signed up.
Does he have any buddies?
I do now.
Schools. We have a panel. If there are others who would like to testify, we'll call them in a minute.
Mr. Chairman, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here on Senate Bill 1036 in support. As was indicated earlier, there are some amendments that we'll be presenting to you. I'm really intrigued by the conversation that's gone on so far. I want to get to the questions in a minute. The background noise for us in the development community is that this has been a perennial issue of construction helping pay for schools. We fought it on SDCs and impact fees for years. We are looking now at a funding possibility that I think makes a lot more sense than SDCs do, makes a lot more sense than impact fees do, broadens the base out to represent what actually is happening in the community with regard to economic development. Housing is not driving school needs. The growing economy is driving housing needs, like the hospital folks said. You have economic development happening. You have jobs being created. They have housing needs. They have school needs. They have fire police needs. They have a bunch of other needs. The way our economy works and the way we're structuring 1036 is trying to mirror that so that we get actually a more broadly based funding source for schools. Will it solve the problem? Absolutely not. But there's some old saying about the perfect and the good that comes to mind. This money could, used by this bill can be put to all sorts of good uses. It will not build a whole lot of schools. You're absolutely right. It will pick up some options and allow school districts to get ahead of the market in fast-growing parts of the region. It may pay for architectural and planning services. It may help them do more planning. I was just in a hearing a few minutes ago down the hallway on Senate Bill 336 for beefing up the requirements for planning between schools and local governments. It may help fund that. I would encourage you not to get bogged down on the issue of, well, does this raise enough money? Because, folks, I got to be honest with you, there's not going to be a bill come out of this building that solves very many problems. The problems are too deep. The money is too big. What we need in this state, and your committee's talked about, I've talked to your committee about it in other venues, is broad tax reform. While we're waiting for that to happen, there are some things we can do to implement pieces of the puzzle that will move things forward. I want to speak a little bit, and I have a handout here that I'll pass around to the committee. The cities and counties don't like being preempted. I understand that. I would point out to you, as previous person testified, it's been a long time that they had this tool. Not many have used it. I prepared a little chart for you here showing the relative toolbox capacity of local governments and school districts. If I might, I'll have this handed out. Yep. When that gets in front of you, just take a quick look at it. There's a variety of funding sources available to local governments. There's very few funding sources available to school districts. I understand the cities and counties angst about having a tool taken out of the toolbox, even if it is a tool that isn't used very often. I'm not particularly sympathetic given the other forms of revenue that are available to them. And I will state again publicly for the record, Mr. Chairman and members, my industry stands ready to engage in discussions on broad tax reform. I've mentioned to you before our willingness to look at Measure 5 and Measure 50. The amount of money raised by this tax, if you take the same logic that was causing some of the questions earlier, that this won't solve many problems at the school level, it ain't going to solve many problems at the local level either. It'll have a lot more impact on the school's ability to do their job, build buildings, plan for their development, so forth, then the diminution will have an impact on the local government's ability to do their job, particularly when you look at the vast options available to cities and counties versus the unvast options available to schools. Now, a lot of the options on that list are difficult politically. That doesn't mean they're not options. I commend this bill to you. I'm really pleased we're able to work with the schools on this. I think it's a good piece of work. It needs to go forward. We need to get this issue behind us and move forward on other issues of tax reform that will help both local governments and schools figure out a more stable path into the future. One last thing, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I want to stress. Some of you asked questions on the impact locally. Representative Butler, you asked about the border communities. This bill is permissive. Any particular community that does not want to impose it should not do so. If they feel it will put their housing at a disadvantage, they should not implement it. We expect that the communities that will use this will be ones where the increase will not be as noticeable. In those communities where affordable housing is still extant, it probably won't be. But keep in mind that this is at the local option, as to rate, as to exemption, as to a number of things. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude. Be glad to take any questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Whitlow. I'm a land use attorney with the law firm of Perkins Coie, but I'm here on behalf of the National Trade Association, the International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSC. ICSC has a national alliance program that seeks to form public and private partnerships to effect development projects or redevelopment projects that have broad community support and add broad community value. We're here to support the exemptions that are in Dash 15 for landfills and brownfields as constrained sites. And so our point is, as we ask for yet another exemption, these, though, are for sites that are different than the other development sites, and we think that that's an important distinction. Not all sites are the same, regardless of the type of use that you're trying to make of them. Many of them are behind, if you would, in the hole, with respect to constraints, and are very difficult under any circumstances to affect the development or redevelopment of. And so what we're our pitch is that we're not trying to take money from schools. We're trying to protect sites that are at the tipping point already of not being able to develop or redevelop. There are national, state, and local policies, public policies that have already been adopted, well-recognized policies seeking ways to facilitate the redevelopment of these types of constrained sites for two reasons. One, to get them cleaned up, and the other is to use them for urban infill and to allow economic development and growth without expanding urban growth boundaries. And so we think that there is a good policy reason to support these exemptions for those types of constrained sites, and so we would urge you to consider the further amendments in Dash 15. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME, the American Federation of State and County Municipal Employees. I'm a little nervous because I'm testifying in opposition to Mr. Chandler's bill, and he kind of scares me. not as much as some other colleagues. We're supportive of giving schools another tool in their toolbox to raise revenue. However, we don't believe that it should be at the expense of local governments. We represent employees in local governments everywhere from Metro to Malheur County, and we're concerned that in this time of shrinking revenue, that take one more tool out of their toolbox and give it to somebody else who is needy and deserves it is fundamentally unfair. Pretty much it. That's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you. I think you said it thoroughly and bravely. Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Okay, thank you. I think I've got it. I was just looking at the Dash 15s, and it's on page 6. Lines 15 through 19 are the preempt language. I was just asking where it is, and I believe I just found it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I just had a question for you about the comment in your testimony about don't get too hung up on how much money potentially this raises, because it seems like one of the things that's already going on is we've had a parade of groups asking to be exempted from this right now. I count at least 5 or maybe 6 so far, and one is sitting next to you at the witness table. So I guess my question would be, how do you draw the line with this? Because to take a tool away from local governments and exempt so many entities that we're not even potentially raising as much money as the bill started with. I mean, I'm, for instance, not sure why the exemption for commercial tenant improvements is in here, which apparently was in here from the beginning of the bill, but it seems like we're going to have no end to people who would like to be let out from under this, and once we open the floodgates, where do you draw the line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, one of the folks who was affected came up to us after hearing a radio story and thought that instead of 50 cents a foot for commercial, it was $50 a foot, which would have prompted us to take residential housing out of the bill at that point. I think there's a lot of people asking for an exemption. I don't think the dollar value represented by those exemptions amounts to very much. I can't speak to all the pieces. In terms of the tenant improvements, the idea there is simply that we're taxing on a square foot basis. If you're moving walls around inside of a structure, there's no square footage added. So you've already paid, assume you build a building, you paid the 50 cents a foot, you come along in a year and change the partitions or do something completely inside that footprint, there's no new square footage, no reason for a new tax. That's the logic behind that one. With regard the agricultural buildings, for example, as Mr. Schellenberg indicated in his testimony, there's already provision in statute for not requiring a building permit. Chances are, if they didn't require a building permit, and if we were silent on the exemption, unless they were silly at the local level, they would not know. We wouldn't know they'd be being built in the first place. We didn't need a permit, therefore no tax. Religious institutions, same kind of logic, that those are commonly exempted. We're trying to follow sort of a pattern in other tax law. With regard to the pieces presented by the Dash 15, for example, I think Mr. Whitlow makes a good point that these are special cases. And again, these are isolated parts. What you're not hearing, for example, is us asking for a special exemption for certain types of residential housing or for the broad commercial community asking for a broad set of exemptions. We did put a cap in for commercial and industrial because that seemed fair. My point, Representative, is I think that, yes, there sounds like a lot of folks lining up in the queue. I don't think the dollar value represented by those amounts to a great deal. In hallway conversations, though, I have reminded them, and I'll take the liberty of reminding this committee, that under current law, these taxes are available to local governments, notwithstanding the fact that they have not been used, and all the folks asking for an exemption would be left to negotiate with the local governments of their choosing as to whether or not they got exempted with perhaps somewhat sketchy results. So I think we'll be having further conversation with some of the potential exemptees about whether or not that's all that wise for them to want to go there.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair? It looks to me like there is an exemption in the bill right now for residential housing that meets certain guidelines for affordability.
Madam, Mr. Chair, I'm absolutely right. The low-income housing, subsidized housing, is exempt. I misspoke.
And a final follow-up, yes, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, so commercial tenant improvements would not include additions, whether it's adding a floor onto an existing building or making any other kind of addition to a
Mr. Chair, President, that's correct. The idea there is if you're doing simply internal, and I'll put it in a residential context, if you're remodeling your kitchen, you would not pay. If you were adding a bedroom, you would.
So is that
any expansion of the footprint, or either vertically or horizontally, would trigger the tax under this proposal?
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is directed to Mr. Whitlow relative to the Dash 15, and I haven't had a chance to review this yet, Mark, but my concern is relative to and I haven't been able to get my arms around it in reading the bill. What of substantial reconstructions? What of moving an existing facility from point A to point B? Is that an existing facility that is moved a home from one street over one block, or the addition of another story? We're seeing that in many instances where people say, we can't afford to build another home, but we can't afford to go upstairs. What does the bill provide for relative to that substantial reconstruction or moving an existing structure in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think the exemption would go to just the nature of the site, not necessarily whether it's already improved or not. It is based on the fact that it would be constrained for either has material contamination, brownfields, which could be from a variety of sources, industrial, old industrial sites, to landfills, which may or may not be brownfields. But it's regardless of the type of development or redevelopment, it's just the nature of the site itself, where there's already a good public policy to try to find incentives to facilitate this type of redevelopment. And so we're saying, this isn't sort of an inverse incentive. Don't load it up with more cost, because it just makes it more difficult to achieve. Whether it is, again, I would find there would be few circumstances where you're going to be moving buildings, mostly demolishing buildings, or cleaning up old foundations, would be mostly the case on the brownfields.
I have a question then for staff relative to this. What happens with regard to the movement of modular homes, mobile homes, those kinds of things within the state, or new mobile homes introduced into the state of Oregon along our borders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that wasn't specifically discussed in the work group. I think moving in an existing structure would not be increasing the square footage. I don't really have an answer for the mobile home moving in. I assume that it probably would be covered.
There would normally be building permits on those kinds of things, Mr. Chair, and I guess my concern is that's one of the only way that families in you know, economically constrained families can really afford affordable housing, and that isn't a project that's defined under the current bill. So I am concerned about that.
Leave it to Representative Butler to raise another problem on any bill in the process of helping us refine bills. Thank you, Representative, very much. Did you have a comment on that?
No, Mr.
Comment? Thank you. Yeah, Representative
Mr. Chair,
Berger.
Quickly, one more quick question. Did I understand from previous testimony, or did I, was I hearing things, that there is nothing in this that would prevent, if a local district were to enact this, school district, they could preempt a brownfield or a religious organization or a hospital on their own if we don't add language like that here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that's correct. The bill would leave that ability open to the to do exemptions at the local level, or for that matter, the rate. It'll set a ceiling, residential up to $1 a foot. They could charge less if they chose at the local option.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm noticing the time. I have several other matters that we need to get to today. Is there anyone else who needs to be heard on this bill today? Thank you very much. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1036. Thank you very much. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3057. Colleagues, we're hearing this bill mostly for convenience at this point, because we're looking at the possibility of combining the provider assessments into one vehicle, and Representative Kotak has graciously indicated that we might look at her bill as a potential vehicle for that. Representative Kotak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Tina Kotek, House District 44. And yes, today before you have House Bill 3057, which I'm very pleased to see it resurface. And as Chair Barnhart said, there might be potential other plans for this bill, which I'd be totally open to. Let me, if I could, just take a minute or two to tell you why we have 3057 to begin with. As you know, we've been depending on provider taxes to fund what is left of our expansion population in the Oregon Health Plan, what we now call Oregon Health Plan Standard. We rely on taxing the managed Medicaid care plans and the hospitals to fund Oregon Health Plan Standard. We have some changes coming down the road in terms of some changes at the federal level that will limit what we can do in terms of taxing the managed care plans. And with the hospital tax, there was some discussion of how long that would be going on. And I have to say thank you to all the providers who stepped up when we were having difficulty in terms of our budget here in the state, when they said, we'll accept this provider tax to keep the health plan standard population at least somewhat viable. And so very appreciative of that. But I put 3057 together because if it's good for the hospitals and the managed care plans, why not look at other health care providers? Because the entire health care system is impacted when we have uninsured individuals. And so while some providers listed in 3057 might not see a majority of the Medicaid patients, the cost shift that comes along with the uninsured affects everybody in the healthcare delivery system. And so when I had Elsie draft this, I said, well, what would the federal government allow us to do in terms of provider taxes? So the list you see in this bill is what is allowed under federal regulations to be taxed with a provider tax. So it's not just hospitals, not just nursing homes, not just health plans. It can be doctors, it can be podiatrists, it can be chiropractors, it could be anybody in the healthcare delivery system. So that's what you have in this bill. Now, whether this goes forward or something else, I just think that this is a discussion we should continue in the interim to look at other ways, other types of funding mechanisms to keep our public coverage alive and kicking. So thank you for hearing the bill today. And like the chair said, I'm happy to be open to any changes that might suit the other needs of the existing provider taxes right now. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Just one quick comment. You've done an admirable job of getting the issue that you wanted to address before the committee, and I congratulate you on that. I do note that on line 12 of page 2, it includes psychological services.
Why is it that, Shepard?
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate
You're welcome.
It. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 3057? Well, questions. Representative Berger.
And just a comment. I will tell you that the minute this bill appeared, Representative, I heard from my doctors. I have in my file a whole bunch of emails.
Oh, okay.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger.
I'm not supporting the bill.
And they weren't crazy about it, I can guarantee you.
Well, and Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, when we did do the public hearing over in the Health Committee, I think one of the only groups that did come forward and talk about was the doctors. And, you know, to be very honest, they have a good point, because our reimbursement rates in the Medicaid program are far too low. And so they take it, you know, in stride to some degree in covering people when we're not reimbursing them at proper levels. And what I said back was, well, if we could get some more money in the system, I have no problem with raising reimbursement rates, because that strengthens the overall delivery system. So if you want to play, that means you get to say how we could perhaps raise your rates. So that goes true for anybody in this bill. So, but thank you for that. I know they were the vocal ones. So.
Yeah.
Thank you. Did I see another hand over here? I guess not. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 3057? If not, we'll close the public hearing and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 814. That's not yours. Huh? All right. Okay. Mary?
Senate Bill 814A. Permits a tax assessor or tax roll officer to correct errors in valuation at any time if the correction results in reduced tax. Clarifies that correction value judgment to accounts that are appraised by the Department of Revenue may not be made without the approval of the department. It takes effect upon current law. Under current law, after the county assessor has certified the tax roll, on or before December 31st, the tax roll officer may correct errors and omissions that were identified prior to the certification date, but the officer may not correct any error in value judgment except when the assessor does so at his or the taxpayer's request, because it reduces the value of the tax property. And this is just a minor change to make it easier, give more flexibility, update the law.
Thank you. Mr. Phillips, Mr. Walraff.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randy Walraff. I'm the assessor for Multnomah County, and I'm here today in regards to a proposal to have a revision to ORS 311-205. It's pretty straightforward, as it was just read in the testimony that you have. The revision would allow the assessor to correct errors in valuation judgment at any time if the effect of the correction is to reduce the tax owed on the account. Currently, under the statutes, we're only allowed to correct valuation judgments between September 25th and December 31st of that current tax year. What this bill does is it allows us, when an account is on appeal to the tax court, if the assessor determines that the value should be lower, that our value judgment, new error information comes in, needs to be reduced, and it results in a tax refund, it allows us to immediately go ahead and change the roll and issue the refund to the taxpayer. I'm open for questions.
And that would have the effect of mooting the appeal, I assume.
No, possibly not. The situation, Chair, is that there are situations where, I'll just give an example of one without the plaintiffs and being mentioned. Roll value is $180 million. The taxpayer is claiming the properties were $60 million. We take a look at it. We go, well, yes, it does need to be lowered. We're at around 110, 120 million. It could take 3, 4, 5 years for this litigation to go through the process. In the meantime, under current statute, we cannot make that value reduction and issue that refund. So this allows us to make that reduction, issue the refund, and then the plaintiff or the taxpayer can continue forward for the value that they want. What this does is it stops the interest, it puts the money back in the taxpayer's hands so that they can use it in their business. And we have had cases over the years that due to various discrepancies or disagreement about the law, it can take a number of years to resolve these legal issues. In the meantime, even though we know we have a reduction we want to make, it sits and waits.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. This bill was brought by Multnomah County, and the department is absolutely fine with it. We see the reasons for it, and we support it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on Senate Bill 814? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 814 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 815. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 815 provides for treatment of property that is transferred from an exempt entity to a taxable entity or for taxable owner or for taxable use. At the current, I guess at the present time, the law does not indicate when a property becomes taxable if it's transferred. And basically this bill will clarify that issue.
Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Randy Walworth, assessor for Multnomah County. This is a Multnomah County proposal for revision to 311-410. It makes more clear and definite in the statutes that property that is transferred from a non-taxable owner to a taxable owner between January 1st and July 1st is taxable for the ensuing tax year. This was clear in the statutes before 1990 when Measure 5 passed. Due to the changing in Measure 5 to a July 1st assessment date, language was changed and dropped from the statutes regarding both taxable and non-taxable status. Then subsequently we went back to a January 1st assessment date with a July 1st lien date. The language about property going non-taxable was placed back in, and the current practice is that properties that go from non-taxable to taxable status is considered taxable. We consider the statutes vague, and based on County Council's advice, we brought forward this clarification for 311-410.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. We think that the proposal makes sense because it we do have a little bit of a strange situation where you've got an assessment date that's 6 months away from the beginning of the tax year, and it kind of makes sense to have whatever taxable status you are on day one, which is July 1st, that's the way you should be treated for the entire year. It makes sense. It's easy to administer. And often between January 1, which is the assessment date, and July 1, the beginning of the tax year, things change. So this gives the assessor some certainty and gives tax collector payers the same certainty as to their tax status.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 815? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 815. Committee, you get out way 2 minutes early. We are adjourned.